so much for joining us once again right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We're joining you from Progressive Radio Network, the best station in the nation for hearing about all things progressive. So many interesting shows that you can get on Progressive Radio Network, and they're all archived. So if you hear something today that you like or you don't like and you want to listen again and make a comment, positive or maybe not so positive, we love it all, go ahead and listen in anytime. We also now have an app. You can go to any one of your app stores and get for free. Just look for the app that's called Progressive Radio Network. Download it and you're in. You can listen then on your phone. You can listen on your computer and any way that you'd like. So we invite you to go ahead and download our free app for Progressive Radio Network. And we do so many classes and workshops. We're actually having one today on food allergies and how they affect you negatively. And that class, and also what to do about it herbally, of course, because we're always talking about natural remedies. And that class actually has 3 CE credits for nurses, midwives, nurse practitioners, massage therapists, nutritionists, RDs, clinical nutritionists, and many other professionals. You can get 3 CE credits for taking any of our classes. So you can go to naturalnurse.com calendar and see the list of classes. And we actually do have one today. Registration is still open. And then I send you the information that you need, and then we're all together on an 800 number to call in. And it's a really nice way to do learning. Of course, on ground is great as well. I have several on grounds coming up. One was just at the Hippocrates Institute in Florida. And, of course, all the on grounds are in Florida because I'm not in the north in the winter, but we will have those in the north in the summer. So when we went to Hippocrates, we went around and gathered wild plants, mostly things that might be considered weeds, and made them into medicine, and you went home with your own medicine. And that course is repeated in the summer at a beautiful biodynamic organic farm on Long Island called Restoration Farm. So I think we already have the date up for that one in June. And then we're doing some just lectures, one's at Life Extension Institute, that's coming up, and another one's at the American Holistic Nurses Association. That's going to be a gut-brain lecture. And, of course, all of them incorporate natural solutions to these issues. And talking about natural solutions, we are so happy to bring on board as our guest today someone who is known as the godmother of American herbalism. And I am talking about the wonderful Rosemary Gladstar. And we're going to talk about her newest book called Herbal Healing for Men, Remedies and Recipes. And Rosemary is literally a star figure in the field of modern herbalism. She is internationally renowned for her technical knowledge and stewardship in the global herbalist community. She's been learning, teaching, and writing about herbs for over 40 years and is the author of 11 books, including Medicinal Herbs, A Beginner's Guide, Herbal Healing for Women, Gladstar Herbal Recipes for Vibrant Well-Being, The Science and Art of Herbalism, and now the new book, Herbal Healing for Men. She lives and works at Sage Mountain Herbal Retreat Center and Botanical Sanctuary, where she also gives classes and workshops, and I know some of the top herbalists in the country apprentice with her there. It's a beautiful 500-acre botanical preserve. She's the founding president of something very near and dear to her heart, which we will talk about, called United Plant Savers. And she is the founder of both the International Herb Symposium and the New England Women's Herbal Conference. Rosemary received an honorary doctorate from National University of Naturopathic Medicine for her lifetime achievements, and currently she serves on the board of directors of the National Health Freedom Coalition and the Association for the Advancement of Restorative Medicine. You can always find more about Rosemary at Sage Mountain. Easy thing to remember, sagemountain.com. So thank you so much for joining us today, Rosemary.
Thanks, Ellen. It's always a pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
Now, we had a lot to talk about. You and I did another show recently together, and just so you know, this show goes all the way till 11 a.m. Eastern time, so we have lots of time to share. So let's go back in time in your history, because many people know you. You are well known. But we have a lot of listeners, because we get about 200,000 downloads of our shows, so there's a lot of people who this might be new for. So why don't you go back in time and share with us how you got involved in herbal medicine?
Oh, great. Well, so, you know, I grew up with a grandmother, actually. And so I grew up in a very traditional way where my grandmother lived nearby to us. And she was an herbalist. She'd come from Armenia in the early 1900s. And she just brought this wealth of knowledge about plants. And she really felt it was, like, I think, somewhat of a religious duty to teach that, to pass that on to her children, partly because she loved the plants, but also because she felt the plants had saved her life. She was a genocide survivor, and it was when they were marching through the desert. She knew enough about the wild plants to be able to stay alive and to help her family. So she passed on some really amazing skills to us. And, you know, I wasn't really signaled out as a child. It wasn't like I received a special blessing, but I was particularly in love with the plants. And in again, that traditional manner, which we find when we look back through time, there was usually people in the family that were the family herbalist. And I think that's really, that calling came to me when I was really young. So really, I would say by the time I was in the sixth and seventh grade, I was fully immersed in plant lore and was doing my science projects on the Native American uses of plants and the wild plants of Sonoma County, where I grew up in California. And it just became a lifelong passion for me. So, yeah, again, I would say that, you know, in the olden days, this wasn't unusual. There was usually somebody in the family that was identified as being a plant lover. Somebody had that, what I call the green blood running through them. And, you know, they were oftentimes cheering by their grandparent or by somebody in the community to carry on their tradition. So I feel really fortunate that it was recognized early in me, and that passion just continued to grow. So, yeah.
That's a wonderful story. And similarly, because my grandmother was from Greece, and she was the herbalist of the community, and she also did a lot of other things like reading tea leaves and delivering babies. Yeah. And like you said, I had 40 first cousins, so all of us had access to her. Yeah. And yet not everybody is interested. There seems to be sort of a passing of the briar that happens naturally, and some of it might be genetic or just a sort of leaning towards a particular interest. I've also seen the opposite. I was an apprentice with an ancient healer in Jamaica who was a Maroon elder, and yeah. He actually had 17 of his own children, none of whom was the least bit interested in mm-hmm. any of his work. And so he actually chose myself and a couple of other people to be his apprentice and to formally hand down his knowledge to, because of our interest, not because of a bloodline. So I guess it could happen different ways.
Well, I think I agree with you totally, Ellen. I think one of the things we see, especially in Central South American islands as well, there was such a lack of interest because I think that it was considered to be very old-fashioned and, you know, not current. And one of the things that I've seen, because I've done a lot of, I also went and met the Maroons in Jamaica, but have spent a lot of time in South America. And what I noticed there, especially in Ecuador, where I travel with a good friend of mine who's an Ecuadorian woman named Rocia Alicorn, what I noticed in those tribes is that the younger people weren't interested, but once we became interested and we were, you know, we would make that effort to travel down there and learn from their elders, that it actually began to stimulate a re-interest in these younger people. So I think some of it had to do with, you know, feeling like left out of the modern world and, you know, that this wasn't like a valuable system anymore, where, you know, in our country, especially around the 60s, there was a resurgence of interest, and that was stimulated, I think, by, you know, that back to the land movement and wanting to return to a more natural way of being. So I think that we actually have a good influence in these cultures by our interest, you know, in their elders and in their traditions. I think
it's also documenting it, like you have, and myself,
yes.
Because when you, some of that knowledge you wrote down while no one else chose to, and if the elder were to pass away, it's like an encyclopedia of knowledge that really could disappear forever.
Yeah. That would be a tragedy because, you know, a lot of it has evolved over centuries, you know, really generation after generation passing this knowledge down and refining it. You know, sometimes people will say that herbalism is very antiquated and old-fashioned, and I always chuckle with that. I never felt my job was to convince anybody, but because I've studied it so long and I've traveled all around the world and studied with indigenous healers, I have such a respect for that old knowledge. And the truth of the matter is it's really the system of medicine that has the most amount of knowledge around it, like hundreds of years. And it's been distilled, so like things that didn't work have been left behind. And, you know, I consider it, it's like a folk tradition, a living folk tradition where the information is continually used, refined, and what works is passed down for others. Where our modern system, which is also, you know, allopathic medicine, which is also another tremendous system, you know, it's like a newcomer on the block, and it's actually not used in the world nearly as much as herbalism. I think the World Health Organization, they stated in the late 1980s that herbalism is still the world's most widely used system of healing. More people around the world, and it's not just developing countries, actually, you know, places like Germany and Switzerland and Japan, which have, and Russia, which have very sophisticated systems of healing, integrate this traditional herbal knowledge into their modern system. So to me, that's the most ideal, you know, way where you kind of incorporate the best of all the systems, so you're using what works best at any given time rather than just the one established system, whatever that might be.
Yeah, that is really the way to go, because I think that was what would be called good, prudent medicine. And using many of these more traditional remedies like you talk about in your books and your new book, Herbal Healing for Men, perhaps use it first, because when we look at efficacy, when we look at safety, it is very often the best choice, especially for some situations which maybe strong pharmaceuticals and surgery may ultimately have to be used for, and possibly not. But using them first when they have such a glaringly large possible adverse effect profile, I think is not prudent.
Yeah, I know. That is one of the good things that we're seeing now is there, you know, is with the resurgence of herbal, of interest in complementary medicines, people actually are making wiser choices now because they have availability of more choices. So oftentimes people find simply by doing exercises or by changing their diets or by some lifestyle changes or herbal remedies that they can avoid some of the stronger medicine that has really sometimes as worse side effects as the actual illness. That's one of the things that we see over and over again. So like you were saying, there's absolutely times that people may have to choose that route, but so often they don't when they're using far more gentler and time-tested remedies. I would say like all of those, like what I call the everyday kind of common things that people have and that they've gotten, you know, so familiar with, running to the drugstore and buying aspirin or, you know, all those simple over-the-counter remedies, that all of those can be dealt with using herbal and home remedies without the cost, without any of the side effects, much more ecologically sound, because that's one of the things I love so much about herbal remedies. They're generally inexpensive and completely ecologically sound, where our modern system medicine is actually considered, it's tragic, it's considered to be one of the biggest polluters of anything that we do, you know, which is questionable, you know, that we create so much pollution and poison from the medicines that we make.
That's true, unfortunately. But that's a very balanced viewpoint. Now let's focus on your beautiful new book, Herbal Healing for Men. You've written so many books and have so much wisdom, Rosemary. Why did you choose this particular topic?
Well, mainly I chose it because there's so little written about it. Like in our herbal world, where we have really, literally, probably 30 or 40 or more books just about women's health, and then unbelievable amounts of books on, you know, everything herbal you can imagine. And even when you look at the modern medical books, you see like at least 10 times more books written for women than you do for men. And so there's just this dire need. And it's definitely not, when you look at the statistics, it's not because men have fewer or less health problems. In fact, you know, when we start to look at the numbers of health issues that men have, they actually are more than women. And the most tragic, I think, statistic is that men still continue to die at least 8 to 10 years sooner than women in general, which is such a statement. You know, that doesn't have to do with genetics. That has to do with lifestyle and prevention and being proactive with our health care. So I just felt there was such a glaring need for it. And really what I would love to see is more men writing more health books. The books that we do have about men are generally, you know, about building muscle mass, and almost always will focus on the penis and the prostate, you know, the two most popular men organs. But, you know, things like cardiovascular health and, you know, muscular health, you know, just building good bones and digestive health and the stress and anxiety, like really dealing with that. So those are all so important to men's health. And more than anything is, I think, that idea of self-care and preventative care. So, you know, we mostly see men, and this is very general. I mean, I know there are men who are really very concerned with prevention and lifestyle, you know, living good lifestyles. But in general, men tend to deal with their health issues when they're critical and acute, not in a preventative way, you know, not like in that daily maintenance way. So I was trying to just introduce these concepts and talk about herbs that are renowned for helping to build long-term vitality and health, herbs that are preventative for heart issues, and also cover remedies as well. But it's more, you know, always with herbalism, the emphasis is it should be on health and well-being, and secondarily on illness and sickness. So
that's so true.
So, Ellen, to answer that,
we know it's
really had special.
Men don't often sort of, you know, go for as many preliminary things. They sort of wait till it's late in the game.
Well, it has to do with training. You know, from the time men are really young, they're trained, you know, not to think about themselves. You know, think about athletes. It's like athletes are prized for, you know, just biting their lips and pulling it all in and, you know, running to the goal line no matter what. I tell this story in the book about my former husband when he was in college football, and he was the quarterback, and he had the ball and was running for the goal line, and he was knocked down and severely injured his shoulder. And he got up, got the ball, and kept running. And he was actually, you know, kind of a hero among his classmates and his coach. But the problem is that he created lifetime damage for that shoulder. And even years and years later, he would tell that story with some pride because, you know, he did it. And also sheepishness because he caused a lifetime injury with his shoulder. But that's very typical for men. You know, they're from the time they're young, they're taught, you know, boys don't cry, stand on your own two feet, you know, just suck it in, be independent. And that, you know, those are good qualities. It's not necessary that they're bad, but they really detach people from their feelings, from how you're really feeling about your physical well-being and also your emotional well-being. And that's changing, thankfully, but, you know, we definitely will see that attitude in our men who are, you know, in their 50s and 60s and 70s that was drilled into most men, sadly and unfortunately.
This is so true. So a lot of it is, you know, sort of social. And I don't know if that's any different in any other kind of cultures either. But nonetheless, we're talking very much here about, you know, the Western man.
Yeah. I would say definitely in any of the Western dominant cultures that that is a generally accepted attitude, you know, both for your emotional well-being and your physical well-being. I don't think it's unique to the United States.
No, definitely not. So when we look at your book, what made you choose the remedies that you did? Because they're really pretty wide-ranging.
They're the ones that are most reoccurring in men. Like I was trying to focus not so much on general things like colds and flus, so I do cover some herbs for that. But that kind of information is so widely available in general herbals, so I really wanted to focus more specifically on imbalances that men are looking at. So there's a lot on cardiovascular health. There's a lot on anxiety, depression, and stress, because those impact both women and men absolutely. But we definitely see that as a major underlying issue for a lot of men today. And also on vitality, feeling fatigued and lack of energy. And again, that's not specific to just men, but it is a focus for men today, that feeling of just being worn out and tired and lacking vitality. Andropause, I definitely cover because there's so little information about that, even though almost every man, once he hits his late 40s and 50s, goes through that. And it's a really big issue both for the men and for people who are living with them, either their male partners or their wives. So that's a really big issue, is andropause. And then, when I got all done with the book, my husband, who's in his 60s, he was talking to a lot of his buddies who were in their 60s. And, they were excited. They know me and they know what I do. Every single one of them asked, it was just across the board. So is there anything on sexual health, And I really felt throughout the whole book, sexual health has so much to do with vitality and feeling good. And, and I felt like all of the herbs that we're talking about sort of help with that. But I realized that if I didn't write a specific section just on sexual well-being, that so many of the men who needed this book would not read it. So there's a big section on, getting it hard and keeping it hard, and sexual health and virility. And so that hopefully will be the hook that draws the guys into the book.
Oh, boy, how sexist to say that men might need that. But you know what? Maybe it's true. But it's certainly something, like you said, that all of those things. And, when we look at ancient traditions, of course, like traditional Chinese medicine, that is really true, that many of the herbs, even something like fo ti, let's say, which is an ancient Chinese, you'll say, anti-aging remedy, really did have a sexual focus when they described the fact that this gentleman who was elderly, his gray hair turns black after he drank water from a river that the plant grew around. Yeah, I don't know if that's true, because I'll tell you, I take plenty of fo ti, and my hair is very white. Not that I even want it to be a different color. I love having gray hair. But nonetheless, when people say, does that really happen? I go, I don't know. Look at me. I never saw it happen. But yet, it does give you a really deep-seated energy. And then the fable went on to describe the fact that he then married several other much younger women and created a whole new family. So that's a lot of what they talk about. It's true.
Almost always. You see it a lot in traditional Chinese medicine, but in the materia medicas around the world, or materia medica meaning the herbs that are used around the world, there's almost always, when herbs are referenced for men, they're referenced as sexual tonics. And really, when you study those herbs, there are a few that are specific to the reproductive organs in men, but almost all of them are classified as adaptogens, which mean that they tone the whole body. They're like nourishing and supportive of just our physical energy. I have to say that there are some herbs that we could say that are, aphrodisiacs and are really going to be stimulate our sexuality. But in general, most of the herbs are building overall well-being. And when we're feeling really good, when we're healthy, when our body is not aching, then generally that's when we find our sexual energy to be stronger. I should clarify, I'm talking about older people, like say in their mid-40s onwards. Younger people, that doesn't seem to be an issue. It doesn't seem to matter how worn out they are. Their hormones are still strong enough that you know, the call of the wild still is, you know, there for them in a big way. But as people age, if they're not maintaining overall well-being, that's one of the things that does happen, is that their sexual energy often wanes. And that's where these herbs are so helpful, because they're revitalizing to your whole system. Herbs like Fotai and Siberian ginseng and Panax ginseng and rhodiola and maca, all of these herbs that have, you know, oftentimes we see classified as sexual tonics, are really adaptogens. They're helping your body adapt to modern-day stresses and restoring vitality. They're pretty awesome, actually. I love that group of herbs. I know you
do. You know what?
Too, Ellen.
Let's take our little first break here, Rosemary, and I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Rosemary Gladstar. We're talking about just her latest book, Herbal Healing for Men. Find out more about Rosemary at sagemountain.com. And when we come back, let's go into some of those specific herbs. So we'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Known as a gadget guy, but I love gadgets that really do the trick, like the new app. The Progressive Radio Network has an app, thanks to our friends at Audio Now. Hey, this is Mark Farrell, host of Insight on Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, where we broadcast live out of New York City. But if you can't catch the show live, no frets. It's always archived. It's always on the app. Download it now, listen later, whenever you want. The Progressive Radio Network app is available from our friends at Audio Now. Check it out.
Hi, this is Mike Fader. I'm here live on PRN every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern. My show, The Turning Point, is a blend of autobiographical storytelling, political and cultural commentary, and lively, intelligent interviews. I hear you asking, Mike, how can I stay sane in the age of Trump? No problem. Just listen to my show. It's all natural, gluten-free, and just plain good radio. That's Mike Fader with The Turning Point every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern, right here on PRN.FM.
I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear.
Greetings, this is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, co-host of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Dr. Eugene Samperone and I are deeply involved with indigenous cultures and combine traditional knowledge with the latest research in natural health care. Join us each week on PRN.FM from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time every Tuesday, or anytime on the archives. Each week, we'll bring you authors, professors, researchers, and activists who are committed to bringing you the latest information which you can use to ensure maximum wellness for yourself, your cells, and your family. Tune in to PRN.FM every Tuesday, 10 to 11 Eastern Standard Time, or listen to the archive at 1-701-719-0884. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, hoping that you stay healthy. Welcome back. More right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We are talking today with renowned herbalist Rosemary Gladstar, the godmother of American herbalism, who has worked her entire life to really bring knowledge and also honor and respect to our plant friends and neighbors who live right by us, and are a major, major part, both of our beingness and our consciousness. So I really want to applaud all your work over so many years, Rosemary.
Oh, Thank you.
And
Helen.
Your
well,
new
you've
book,
been doing
Herbal Healing for Men, is beautiful. It's full color. It's beautifully written, and it's very easy to use. So we're going to talk about some of the specific herbs, but I don't want to end the show, and you know how fast time flies. Let's talk for a minute about United Plant Savers, because I know you want people to know about that.
Thank you so much, Helen. Yeah. You know, I have to say that with everything I've done in my life with herbs, United Plant Savers is the thing that's closest to my heart because it's really about the plants. You know, we're so excited to see herbalism become popular again. I know when I first started my practice, it was like in the early 1970s, there were still so few people using herbs, and there were hardly any companies, there were hardly any herb stores, it was hard to find herb schools, and all of that has changed in the last 40 years. You know, we just see herb stores, and here we're having a program, and people are listening to it, and we have conferences all over the country, and big companies have sprung up that are making incredible products, many of them. And but as that was happening, there was very, very little thought for the plants themselves. And a group of herbalists, it was in the early 1990s, actually 1994, we got together because we were concerned. You know, we were happy to see herbalism flourishing the way that it was and happy to see people using the plants again. But we were very concerned for the plants, especially our indigenous, our wild plants that are native to the North American continent, because so many of the remedies and recipes were being made from these wild plants. And so, you know, we got together and we did surveys and we talked to the Fish and Wildlife and, you know, the Department of Agriculture. We just kind of reached out and we all realized that, that you know, our native plant populations were actually in danger of some of them even disappearing. And it wasn't so much because of plant lovers, you know, of the herbal communities, but primarily because of habitat destruction, poor logging practices, urban sprawl, the same things that are affecting wildlife everywhere across the North American continent. But as plant lovers, we felt like that we could and should do something about it. So we formed this organization, United Plant Savers, to be a voice for the plants. And it's been amazingly successful, actually, in the last, I think we're going to be celebrating our 25th anniversary next year. You know, we've actually become a voice in the industry where people are still using wildcrafted plants. That means plants from the wild, but almost always those are the weedy species, and those plants that are more indigenous and native here are primarily being cultivated. So we've shifted from using and organically cultivated, I might stress, so that they're being cultivated under really good growing techniques and good for the soil, as well as good for people who use them. So, it's just, you know, it's an organization that's primarily about ensuring that these plants that have such a long tradition of being used in herbal medicine, both in this country and in other parts of the world as well, that they'll be here for future generations of plant lovers, but also really for the plants themselves and the plant communities and nature. Because that's, you know, I want to just maybe close with that statement is that so oftentimes when we're using these things, we're thinking about, you know, how they benefit us, but we forget often that really the plants themselves have their own communities and that they have an integral place in the whole of nature, that when we remove these ancient plants from their native habitats, plants like golden seal and false unicorn root and black and blue cohosh and bloodroot, all of which are native to the Northeast, when they're taken out of their native environments, all of the plants and the animals are impacted by that, and we haven't even begun to realize the depths of that complexity. So, yeah, you know, as a plant user, as somebody who's using plants, even if you're just taking echinacea and golden seal for a bad flu or a cold, it's imperative that we're conscious and aware of where these plants are coming from and that we're supporting sustainable uses of them.
It so is, and I know you're involved in many different venues. For instance, Emily Ruff, who I know is a wonderful herbalist, and she's running the Florida Herbal Conference, and I'll be presenting there, and she definitely talks a lot about plant savers, and it's integral as part of the entire conference, and it's really a wonderful, wonderful organization.
Yes, it is. I have to say, it really, you know, up until United Plant Savers was formed, we were just going along as an herbal community and an herbal industry, not even conscious of where these plants were coming from. We loved the plants. We valued them traditionally and their modern uses. But we weren't really even looking at how these plant communities were thriving. And we know for the Native people in this culture, that kind of intimate relationship with the plants and their place in the great web of life was integral and important to their medicine. But so many of those teachings were lost when the newcomers came to this land and didn't respect the elders that lived here. So those very teachings that would have tied us in to how those plants not only healed us, but also helped to heal the earth and helped, you know, heal their own plant communities, those teachings were gone. And so we had to rediscover them and, you know, kind of reestablish them. I think we've done a pretty good job. There's a lot of work still to do, but at least it's part of the conversation these days.
That's so true. And thank you for, you know, conceptualizing that concept and promoting it for so many years into, you know, for the public good as well as for our plants good. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
So let's move into talking about some of these great, great herbs. And I'll just let you choose, because every herb in this book is fully illustrated, not necessarily with a giant history about its use, but with what to do for it right now in a very, very easy, full-color way. And that's what I think is one of the really strong points about this book. And we are talking about herbal healing for men. So you choose one to start out with, Rosemary, that you'd like to share.
Well, that's a good question. Now, I think I'm going to start with ashwagandha. I want to start with something that's really incredibly potent, but used for general well-being. And ashwagandha, it sounds like such a strange herb. I mean, sometimes they sound so exotic, but it's actually a very common herb that has a 5,000-year history in Ayurvedic medicine, which is from East India. And it's Ayurvedic medicine is gaining a lot of renown in this country, the same as traditional Chinese medicine did in the 80s. And there are some wonderful Ayurvedic practitioners, but what I really love about that system of medicine is it integrates so well into our Western system of medicine. So ashwagandha grows very easily in this country. You can grow it in your backyard. You can grow it in your garden. It's a very hardy plant. And it's primarily the root that's used, and it's an adaptogen. It's classified as an adaptogen, which means that it helps our body adapt to modern-day stresses, and it restores and revitalizes energy. So ashwagandha is an herb that was used a lot like our American ginseng was, or like the Asian ginseng. It was used for restoring energy, and it was always classified as a sexual tonic and primarily used by men. But as we were talking about earlier, that's more historically how men were taught to think about their bodies. You know, it was sex and nothing else. And so a lot of the old herbal information really emphasizes that. But really, ashwagandha is a sexual tonic, but primarily it works in that way through restoring vitality in the body. And so it also, one of the things that's nice about it is that it's a relaxing herb as well. So it stimulates sexuality, it activates the body, but it does that in a way that's also relaxing and non-stressful. In India, it's the primary drink that's drank in the evening time by literally thousands and thousands of people. It's probably the number one drink that's used as an evening drink for kind of calming and relaxing the body. It's not the most tasty herb, so those people who want to rush out and try it, I would suggest using it the way that they do in India, which is warm a little milk, and it doesn't have to be dairy. It can be almond milk or, oat milk. And then you add ashwagandha. It's usually like a teaspoon per cup, and then a little bit of honey and cinnamon. So it makes it very tasty and very relaxing. If people aren't allergic to dairy, I would say to use the cow's milk, because that high calcium in it is very, very relaxing to the nervous system as well. So it's a relaxing herb that actually also is activating. And I know that seems like a counterindication or a odd statement, but many of our herbs work in these either-or ways. They work by balancing your system. And so they're not like forcing your body to be overstimulated or to have a drug-like reaction that puts you to sleep. So it helps you feel relaxed but also perky and alive. So for people, especially people who have sexual issues around sexual performance or stress, who just get so uptight, this is a very, very excellent herb to use because it restores the body, relaxes the body, and also energizes the body. Yeah, all in one herb. We have over 5,000 years of written history about this herb and also lots of modern research that confirms the very things I'm speaking about. So it's a great herb to use, and it's readily available. As I said, you can grow it, but you can also buy it in herb stores. It comes as powders, so you can mix it in with like a blender shake or mix it with the warm milk, as I was just mentioning. It also comes as tinctures and in capsule form as well.
I love the plant itself. I grow it here in Florida, and it's beautiful bush. It gets red berries on it, and it did not get pulled out by my gardeners, which many of my herbs do if they don't like how it looks. But this is a beautiful plant. And, of course, what's used medicinally, I'm not sure if those berries are used at all. I know what they're usually using in the medicinals you're talking about is the root. And
yes,
I don't like to use my root because I don't want to dig up my plant, but I just love to look at it.
I know. I have that same problem now. When I was younger, I could do it readily. As I get older, it's like, no. Well, so it belongs to the Soleaceae family, the same family as tomatoes and the nightshade. So the aerial part, the leaves and the berries, are actually not used and may even have slightly toxic properties. So it's primarily the root. But you don't have to dig your beautiful root. It's so readily available and not that expensive to use. So ashwagandha is an herb that I recommend for all the reasons that we were just speaking. And then there's also a plant called Siberian ginseng that is a Panax. It's related to the Panax ginseng, which is the most famed of the sexual tonics for men. And Siberian ginseng has many, many of the same properties. It's classified as an adaptogen. And, in fact, there's probably more research done on Siberian ginseng as an adaptogen than any other herb that we have. There's literally thousands and thousands of quite rigorous scientific research that was done on it because it was a plant that grew in Russia. And in the 1940s and the 1950s, the Russians were very intent on finding both plants and chemicals that would stimulate people to be able to work longer hours and be more productive, of course, so that you'd have better factory workers. And Siberian ginseng was one of those plants that was researched on literally, as I said, thousands of Russians. Thankfully, it has really good overall tonic properties, so it was actually a good herb, and it was found that, in fact, it did increase immune health. People got sick less often. They had more energy. It was also classified as a sexual tonic, but once again, I just want to emphasize that that would be because of its overall well-being properties, you know, of helping the overall being feel healthier and more resilient. So, and the reason I recommend it actually even over the Panax ginsengs and our native ginseng is because it's abundant. It's not a taproot. It's not like a very at-risk and endangered plant. It's a plant that actually does grows into a big shrub, a big, big bush actually, almost tree-like, and it has a very, very large root, and it's the root that is used, and you don't have to dig the entire plant. You can actually, you know, dig the root and just use sections of the root. So it's much more abundant and prolific than the Panax ginsengs, which are really, all of those are at risk and endangered. Our Department of Agriculture still allows people, and the Fish and Wildlife still allows people to harvest ginseng. They say it's very monitored, et cetera, but really, it's actually, I would really argue about that. It's so at risk in its native environments in the North American continent, and the populations that we have are under so much stress. So we really emphasize try not to use wildcrafted ginseng, but to use cultivated ginseng and to use the Siberian ginseng, which is much more abundant and really does just about everything the same.
It is a great herb, and we're going to take one more break right here on The Natural Nurse, and Dr. Z will give a little listen to a natural medicine chest, which is part of our book, The Natural Medicine Chest, just the audio version. And when we come back, we will continue our discussion with Rosemary Gladstar and focus on more of the wonderful herbs she talks about in her newest book, Herbal Healing for Men. And do take a note that you can listen to this show anytime, because we do archive it, and if you like something here and you want someone else to listen, they can at any time. And also you can find Rosemary at sagemountain.com. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss Sar sarsaparilla, or Smilax officinalis.
Sar sarsaparilla is a tropical plant which grows in South America, Mexico, and Guatemala. Although most Americans are familiar with it as a flavor enhancer for root beer, it has also been used for its beneficial properties for hundreds of years by many different cultures. In Roman times, the young shoots were eaten, and the mature vines were worn as garlands at festivals of Bacchus. According to ancient Roman writings, Sar sarsaparilla originated when the beautiful maiden, Smilax, was turned into a shrub after her love was slighted by the young crocus.
Sar sarsaparilla was brought to Europe in the 16th century by Spanish traders. A French physician, Nicolas Monardus, published a comprehensive account of Sar sarsaparilla as a treatment for syphilis in 1574. During Portuguese military operations in 1812, a British inspector general of hospitals noted its positive effect on syphilis patients. It has also been used in China for treatment of the same condition. Sar sarsaparilla was included in the United States Pharmacopoeia until 1950 as a recommended treatment of secondary syphilis.
Sar sarsaparilla's medicinal action appears to be a result of binding bacterial endotoxins in the gut, thereby decreasing their absorption. This greatly reduces the stress on the liver and is likely responsible for its historic use as a tonic and blood purifier.
In a controlled study of 92 patients published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1942, a chemically active component of Sar sarsaparilla, called sarsaparin, greatly improved psoriasis in 62% of the patients and resulted in complete clearance in 18%. Sar sarsaparilla is often recommended by naturopathic physicians for gout, arthritis, and psoriasis. Another folkloric use for Sar sarsaparilla is as a tonic for male sexual potency.
So, if you want a root beer flavored tea with a long history as a healthy tonic, reach for the Sar sarsaparilla in your natural medicine chest.
Welcome back once again to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, and you can always find us at naturalnurse.com. You can look at our books. You can check out the classes. They're listed under calendar. You can join the mailing list if you'd like. Just type in your email in the lower left-hand corner of the front page. You can visit us on Facebook at Natural Nurse. Facebook. So we're available sort of, 24/7, and we'll get back to you as we can. And we're here today with our guest, Rosemary Gladstar. We're talking about her latest book, Herbal Healing for Men, Remedies and Recipes. And thank you for that discussion about what has been called Siberian ginseng, Rosemary. One of the things I find it works so well for also, I will combine it very often with sage and rosebuds. And I have found that's a really nice, gentle, mood-lifting combination, especially for those people who can't use St. John's wort, which is very active in terms of its interaction with pharmaceuticals.
Yes, yes. Wonderful. That sounds like such a good formula. I love that you were talking about
the other thing I do want to point out. If someone goes to the store and wants to buy Siberian ginseng, these are one of these, you know, going into the politics of herbal medicine, which is a giant discussion in and of itself, that it's actually not legal to call it Siberian ginseng anymore.
We have to refer
to it as Eleuthero.
That's so true. I always call it that because of... Actually, that was changed, I think, in the 80s because people were getting confused with our Panax ginsengs, with the Asian ginseng, and they didn't want people to buy the Eleutherococcus, the Siberian ginseng, and think that it was a Panax ginseng. So it was
exactly, but it was so terrible, you know, on a lot of levels, because if someone was looking for Siberian ginseng, now it moved in the health food store from being under S to being under E, and they would just think, oh, the store's out of it. I mean, it was really massive confusion over that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. It's sad and funny in terms of the politics, and that's what's so wonderful about your book. Because since you are not selling any product, you are free to actually discuss what they can be used for and how to use them, along with these really simple and beautiful recipes.
Yeah, I do have a lot of freedom in that way, you know, and thank goodness we still have freedom of speech in this country, so we can write. We can write the truth. That's a good thing.
We can. But, for instance, if you had, like, if you were recommending a specific brand or showed a bottle of, let's say, if you had a company and you're ginseng or you're anything, then you can't, which is just, again, counterintuitive in terms of helping people learn and allowing them to know what to do. So I really suggest people have a full shelf of your books so you can look up what you need, and you actually have it broken down into, you know, what someone might want to use it for, and you give the recipes. And then some really fun things, too, like what about, I love this, maximum matzo balls. Is that like matzo balls? What are matzo balls, Rosemary? Those sound great.
You know, I love bringing herbs into the kitchen and making them a part of people's everyday life and making them delicious. Because I've found, of course, with even if you have the best remedy in the world, if somebody's not willing to take it, it's not going to do a bit of good. So there's a lot of recipes that are, you know, where you're making candy balls and, you know, sometimes using like a nut butter or honey, and also like shakes, you know, really just taking your powders and putting in shakes or making herbal honeys. And so there's a lot of really good tasting, simple, really simple, like here's three or four steps, you know, to make something that's really delicious. So the matzo balls, it's just a basic formula where I take different powders and mix them in, either with just honey and a little cocoa powder, you know, using a really fine bittersweet cocoa powder, or sometimes using a nut butter so you're actually making like a, you know, like an energy ball. And then using, you know, I'll add things that taste really good like chocolate chips or coconut or chopped nuts. And I'm famous for my... Oh, this sounds terrible. I'm famous for my balls, but like, you know, making those really good candy balls. So I make those Zoom balls, energy balls, the maca balls. Maca is another really renowned herb for men. And again, it's often classified as a, you'll see it written oftentimes as a sexual tonic, gained a lot of fame in this country, though it has a long-term use in South America. But really, again, it's an adaptogen. It's good for men and women, and it's particularly delicious. I don't know if you've ever tasted it, but it actually tastes a little bit like butterscotch. It has a really nice flavor.
Yeah, and
so it's really,
and they actually,
yeah.
I've seen places where they make maca at little cafes on the street, and very often couples will come and enjoy it together on a night out. You know, maybe they're going to have a loving session later. So it isn't uncommon for both men and women.
No, I would say that any of the herbs that are classified as sexual tonics we find are good for men and women. And some may be a little bit more specific, like yohimbe, which is a very powerful and potent herb. And it's not an herb that I write about lightly or suggest that people use readily because it is almost drug-like in its actions. In fact, it's used by the pharmaceutical companies. They extract a chemical, the yohimbine, out of it. And use it specifically as a sexual tonic for men. But that one there, I would say, is probably, it is used by women as well, but it has probably is more specific to men's sexual energy. But most of them are tonics for the reproductive system and therefore work well. But if you look at any of the early herb books or read any of the early literature, they're always recommended for men. Very, very seldom do you see sexual tonics recommended for women. Go figure, you know.
Well, probably they figured, you know, women weren't too interested in sex, so that could be what it is. Who knows? It's hard to say, but, you know, there's sexual mores that follow us. And, yeah, thank you
for
the heads up about Yohimbe. Well, I find it is extremely effective to actually help with things like erectile dysfunction, especially when it's linked not so much to psychological problems but circulatory problems. It is, however, a very active herb in terms of herb-drug interactions. And also, it can cause anxiety in some people and insomnia. So it's one of the stronger ones. Maybe it's not the first one you want to try.
Yeah. Yeah, I did write about it in the book and suggested how to use it and talked a little bit about the traditional uses, but also put counterindication on people to be mindful of using it. But, you know, one other herb that I just really want to recommend is hawthorn, because that herb is one of the most cardiovascular friendly. It's so good as a tonic for the heart and the circulatory system. It's so readily available. It grows throughout North America. In fact, you can find it growing in all the temperate places of the world. And it has a long, long history of being used both as a tonic for the heart muscle, but also for emotions and grief and sorrow. It's just one of my favorite herbs. I love the berry and the flower and leaf. I use all parts of that plant. It makes a wonderful syrup. You know, hawthorn berry syrup is just a wonderful way to take it as a nice daily tonic. And it can also be used as a tincture. It can be used in powder form and put into those candy-like balls that we were speaking about.
It is an unusual herb, too, because it has a delicious flavor and is calming and yet strengthening.
Without
nervousness, so I do highly recommend it as well. Well, believe it or not, we've come to the end of our time together, Rosemary, but I do want you to just shout out to everyone how they best can find you and just give us all a parting herbal blessing.
Oh, thank you, Ellen. Well, thank you so much for having me on the show, and people can find me at my website or they can come visit me at Sage Mountain in Vermont. But my website is sage@sagemountain.com. And, I just want to say that herbalism is such an ancient system. It's part of our human upbringing, really, and it's so easy to learn. People sometimes are intimidated because they don't know about it. But that beginner's herb book that I wrote is just a simple introduction. Or take one or two classes from Ellen, and you're going to find that, oh, this stuff is easy and fun and delightful. And it keeps us healthy, and it makes us feel happy. So, have a wonderful day, and thank you so much for having me on the show again, Ellen.
Thank you, Rosemary. Many blessings on your path, and be well.
Thank you, and the same to you. Bye-bye.
And the same to you, listeners. Until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.